When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Nutrafol, we don't just help your hair, we help your body grow it. Because it's never just about your hair. It can be your job, or your deodorant, or your lunch, or just normal life. That's why our whole body approach targets the key root causes of hair thinning. Discover your root causes and why we're the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com. These statements have not been approved by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease paid for by Nutraceutical Wellness, Inc.
What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. My guest today is one of the smartest people I know, not just in sports, not just in the NBA, but one of the smartest people I know, period. And especially in the area of player health, which is kind of important right now during the NBA playoffs. He is Dr. Robbie Sicca, formerly a VP with the Minnesota Timberwolves, overseeing player wellness there for a couple of years. He's now the team doctor for the Yankees. He's a senior consultant to the Denver Broncos. He's chair of the COVID Sports and Society Work Group. He is founder and CEO of the Sports Medicine Analytics Research Team and a bunch of other stuff that I won't go into. Point being, he's very smart, very in demand, and very busy. So appreciate Robbie making some time to come back on the pod. This seemed like the perfect time to bring Robbie back on the pod. The playoffs so far have been excellent, but we've had six All-Stars already missed time, and this just a year after a record 10 All-Stars missed time in the 2021 playoffs. What does that mean? What is the NBA learning? What are people like Dr. Sicca learning from this trend and this rash of injuries 2 years running? Is it about the pandemic and the schedule? I put that all to him. We've also had COVID determine a couple of really critical moments in this postseason. First, Paul George with the Clippers. He was out for health and safety protocols the night they were bounced from the play-in. That certainly had an effect. And then this week, Zach LaVine of the Bulls, he was out because of health and safety protocols, you know, essentially quarantined for COVID, for their elimination game against the Bucks. I wanted to get Robbie's insight on all of this, not just the rash of injuries, but COVID. You know, this is, it's not behind us. It's not done. The NBA's protocols are kind of subsided, but they still have to quarantine guys if they come up positive. Is COVID potentially going to dictate the outcome of the playoffs, even the finals? It seems like it's on the table. I put all that to Robbie Sicca on the pod. We also discussed Kevin Durant's amazing comeback from Achilles over the last couple of years, Chris Middleton's knee sprain, how long he might be out for the Bucks. Talked a little bit about load management, minutes restrictions. Is injury prone a real thing? Plus, Robbie has great insights and stories about Wolves star Anthony Edwards from their time together in Minnesota. You don't want to miss that. Before we get to all that, a quick reminder, please rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. If you have feedback, hit me on Twitter at Howard Beck. Okay, my conversation with Dr. Robbie Sicca is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now pleased to welcome back two-time guest. He gets another stamp on the little card. Dr. Robbie Sicca. Robbie, how are you, sir?
Good, Howard. How are you? Good to be back.
Good. After 10 appearances on The Crossover, I think you get a free cup of coffee or something.
Good to know. As long as it's some New York coffee, maybe a little bagel, I'm good with it.
I can get you some really good bagels, my friend. You just say the word. I will Ziploc them and ship them overnight, FedEx. I got a spot.
That's awesome.
Do not mess with the New York bagel scene. Appreciate you joining me on what is draft morning for one of your gigs, the Denver Broncos. We are recording this on Thursday, but coming up Friday night, and this podcast will be out by then, your Minnesota Timberwolves, your former gig, where you spent two quality years. They will be going up against the Grizzlies again for game six. And we're going to get to a bunch of other stuff here. Of course, Robbie, I want to talk about player health and player welfare and load management and COVID concerns and all these areas that, of course, you have spent a lot of time thinking about, setting policy on, everything else. But before we get to all that, we should just talk some basketball. That was your team for two seasons. And still, you're still Minneapolis based primarily. So what do you think of your Timberwolves? What have you seen? Did you see this coming?
Look, as someone from Minnesota, grew up a Timberwolves fan, it's great to see them play well. It's great to see them overcome a little bit of adversity and really compete. I think it's probably been the most entertaining and compelling first round series. You've seen Carl play through some adversity, obviously had some struggles in the play-in game and has really played very well in this series, I think. This is the nation's introduction to Anthony Edwards, one of my favorite players and favorite personalities that I've ever gotten a chance to work with. He's just a dynamic person and player. For everybody to see that raw athleticism, I think has been something that probably has been pretty eye-opening for the country. And then you've got all of the different sort of within game stories of the comebacks and the Ja Morant dunk and, you know, the fourth quarter execution, the ATO that Chris Finch drew up there. That was a great shot for Anthony Edwards. There's been so many good little nuggets from that series. It's been a lot of fun to watch.
Anthony Edwards. So for people who, you know, might've seen him at a distance, right. And maybe knew him as a prospect, or they saw some of the highlights, I feel like up until this time, because nothing, you know, really nothing settles in until the playoffs, right? You make your first playoff appearance and that's when you really get the attention of the, you know, sports watching public in a different way. But I feel like he already had broken through on two levels, Robbie. There's the dunks and just the incredible athleticism, the incredible power in his game. But also, like, every time you see him in an interview, dude is just entertaining as hell. Like, he just seems naturally funny. He has this kind of raw candor where it's like he doesn't really care what he's saying or how it's he just says what's on his mind. He's just really refreshing. Is that how he was behind the scenes as well? Is this just this kind of you know, raw on every level? The raw athleticism, raw personality.
Maybe I'm going to date myself a little bit. Remember Shaq from Blue Chips?
I covered Shaq for 7 years and I never actually saw Blue Chips, which is a strike on my basketball movie resume.
But you have a guy who's like, you know, from like the rural part of New Orleans and Louisiana. And here's a guy who, like, you know, he's from Atlanta, but he's just a raw personality, just like you said. But when we got him in a room during the interview process and when we started evaluating him, there were things that you're like, this is exactly who he is. Everywhere, like, he's so consistent and within himself that, like, when I asked him, I said, why does this matter to you, Anthony? And this was just he and I talking. Like, we had a lot of private time during the whole draft process and the interview process because I was evaluating the health and the performance and kind of the physical components. We just talked a lot. And he said, you know, look, man, I want to make my mom and my grandma proud. I want to make my city proud. I want to make whoever takes me, like, I want to make the fans there proud. And I'm going to do that by smiling every day. And I was like, just by smiling? He's like, man, doesn't matter. You come into work every day, you come into the arena and you're smiling every day. Nobody's going to be mad at you because they're going to see that you're just happy and you're doing your best. And you see that. And then he's that good of an athlete. He's that good of a leader. Like, the way he complimented McLaughlin and teased him and gave him a hard time after the win. That's the personality. That's why people like Ricky Rubio said he was the best leader that he's ever been around when I was there. Like, he has that type of personality that brings people together, that makes people want to play with him. It's incredible. And it's exactly who he is because he's so true to himself.
He just seems so genuine, right? And he just exudes that joy and that genuineness. The fact that, like, I'm not thinking through any of this. I'm not plotting it out. There's no facade there. And I think that's what helps us, you know, as, you know, whether it's fans or the media, that's how we connect with guys, right? Like, the players who really feel that connection with are the ones, it's never just the play. It's never just how dominant they are, how athletic they are. It's in a lot of cases, I think it really is a matter of like, there's an affinity you can feel even through the TV screen because somebody just seems, it's in Ant Edwards' case, so genuine. He radiates this kind of, almost like an innocence. There's an innocence and joy to his game.
Absolutely. And you want him to succeed. And, you know, I'll just tell you a couple of the thoughts that we had during the draft process. The draft, obviously, that year was in November because it was the, you know, the 2021 COVID delayed start. Had he been drafted originally, he would have been 18. So he was 19 when we drafted him. But then you go back and you think about the other 18-year-olds and you're like, okay, he's not 19 at the draft. He's 18 in any normal year. Okay, what's an 18-year-old who's this talented, who's this good? What do they become? And you start to think about, well, okay, there's clearly a superior level of talent. And then when we worked him out, I had him run his sprint test three times because I said, this is not like, there's no way it's this fast. He's faster than anyone I've ever seen. Like he's faster. And everybody talks about his downhill explosiveness. He's almost like a Gronk or a high level wide receiver in the NFL in terms of how quickly he gets from point A to point B. And you see it all the time. And it catches you off guard because here's this goofy, innocent kid smiling and he has this explosiveness that he has that ferociousness, but it's a different level of ferociousness than Ja because Ja is a little bit more of a slight person. He catches you off guard because you're like, this guy can leap out of the room. And the violence of the dunks is truly like something that's stunning. But for Anthony Edwards, like everything about him is he's like a Sean Taylor or a Gronkowski. Like his body is that of an elite NFL player. And he's fun and he's gotten better and he's processing the game differently. And he's a kid who's 20 years old and the world is at his feet, man. He's going to be really, really good for a long time in this league.
Timberwolves got a special player there. It's a lot of fun to see. And it's always fun to see when they first get a chance, when young stars first get a chance to make their debut in the playoffs and put a stamp on things in a more of an official, meaningful way. And that's the other aspect of him too, right? Like I talk about this innocence. He also, because he's got these blinders on and everything is just fun for him, it doesn't seem like he feels any pressure. Like this is a guy who, this does not look like his playoff debut. He's hitting big shots. He's delivering in clutch moments. Like he is not awed by the stage at all. And you know, that's not always the case. Even if you're the number one overall pick, we've seen plenty of other guys kind of, buckle a little bit in those situations.
Well, and I think he's got a good dynamic with Carl because Carl's an emotional player. He wears his emotions on his sleeve and I'm really close to Carl. He's one of my favorite people in the world. I truly like have a unique relationship with that kid. And for him to overcome some of the bumps of this series, like this is his team. He is the leader for now on that team. For him to be able to play well in games, for him to be able to go through some of this, one of the things that I've told people is great teams look back and they have losses like the Timberwolves have from this series. It may take a year, it may take 5 years, it may take 10 years for you to look back and say, hey, that was the series where you grew up. Now, not every team that has losses like that becomes a great team. But if you're going to become a great team, you have to have some of those bumps to be able to get to where you want. And I think this is a young team coming together, similar to Memphis last year, you know, playing Utah and losing that series. I think they've grown up. I think Taylor Jenkins has done a fantastic job, getting more out of Brandon Clark. He's averaging 6 points more per game. You've got guys like, you know, Tyus Jones shooting over 50% from three. And Desmond Bain has been outstanding, just truly like a guy who has rose to the occasion in the playoffs. And then you've had other guys who, you know, haven't played as well in the playoffs, whether it's Dylan Brooks or some other folks. He's been able to figure out how to get his guys to play hard for four quarters, come back. It's been a terrific series. It's great to see the NBA's product be as good as it is right now in the playoffs. It's great for the league. Everybody should feel really good. And I think it's going to be a fun game six. And I'm pretty optimistic there's going to be a game seven.
It's funny, Robbie. On the one hand, you know, LeBron is not in the playoffs, right? The Nets are already out of the playoffs. So the two super teams are gone. And so no LeBron, no Anthony Davis, no Russell Westbrook, no Kevin Durant, no Kyrie Irving. And yet these playoffs, like I don't think anybody's I don't want to say no one misses those stars. You always want the biggest players. And then to me, like it's just sad not seeing a player of LeBron's caliber, especially when he did play this season. He was having MVP caliber season. So I want to see those guys on the stage. It is a very good sign for the NBA that in a way we almost have not missed some of those superstars who didn't make it or are out early because of young teams like the Grizzlies and Timberwolves and others who are breaking through. But on the down note, and let's you know, segue to this, the record, according to the Elias Sports Bureau, and I'm now poaching for my buddy Mark Stein's newsletter, but 10 All-Stars missed at least one game in the playoffs last year. That was a record, according to the Elias Sports Bureau. And so far, we're not even through the first round yet, 6 All-Stars have missed at least one game in this postseason. That's Devin Booker, who is possibly making his return soon. Chris Middleton, who's seemingly going to be out for another couple of weeks at least. Luka Doncic, Jimmy Butler, Fred VanVleet, and of course, Zach LaVine, asterisk, not injury. That was COVID health and safety protocols. We will get to COVID later in the pod. But that's 6 guys, and we're not even out of the first round yet. And then, you know, there's some other things lingering too. Andre Iguodala, obviously one of the older players in the league and not an all-star, so not part of that list, but, you know, a big concern for the Warriors. Robbie, what is happening over these last 2 postseasons? Is this just, you know, a cyclic thing? Is it an anomaly? Is this part of the NBA's, just the backlash health-wise to the pandemic and all the various, you know, weird aspects of the schedule the last couple of years? What's going on with player injuries in the postseason?
Well, I think, you know, you do have a lot of stopping and starting for guys because of COVID this year. I mean, January was a tough month for the country. We lost 60,000 people across the country. But over the course of the season, I mean, just before we even talk about the postseason, think about the fact that 9 players this year missed all 82 games. That's a lot of guys who were good players. I mean, you're talking about TJ Warren, Kawhi Leonard, Jonathan Isaac, Jamal Murray, James Wiseman, Zion, Saric, Simmons, John Wall. Like that's a lot of guys who missed the entire year. The game is really changing, Howard. This is not a game of cutting. This is not a game of pivoting. You don't have guys who are really big players playing in the post. It's stopping and starting. It's getting to the rim. It's pulling up for 3. And how we train athletes does impact how guys perform in the playoffs. Most of the guys that we've talked about are older players or who've had health issues in the past. And so I think this does beget, how do we talk about re-injuries, risk? And we've enjoyed the playoffs because despite all of the guys that you mentioned, there's been younger players who've stepped up. That's the nature of the game. But I think we really do need to take stock in the fact that soft tissue injuries are going up, hamstring injuries, Achilles tendon injuries, they're going up across the league. We do see fewer ACL injuries because we have less cutting and pivoting. But because of the game changing, we probably need to evolve in how we train players. And look, everybody wants to shoot 3s now. The shooting volume and how we optimize, you know, how many shots should somebody be putting up? You know, we hear all the stories of players taking 900 shots, you know, or 1500 shots after practice. Is that good? At the same time, you go back to the 90s, and the mentality of certain players was a little bit different, right? Like guys would go out at night, they'd come in and they'd play in the playoff game and it might not matter. The world is just a little bit different. And I think we just have to take stock in where we're at. But yeah, it's a lot of injuries. I think we're going to continue to see this in the future.
Do you think, Robbie, that our teams, is this one of those things where teams are sharing information, our medical staffs sharing information about what you're noticing, these trends, and that we're going to have to adapt to the way that we manage the season to avoid some of this? And of course, just real quick on that list, you noted of the guys who didn't play all 82. Obviously, you know, John Wall is a weird case. He could have played. That was, you know, an arrangement with the Rockets. But yeah, the rest of those guys, it's just been, you know, tough injuries or surgeries and long recoveries. But is this something that the NBA is grappling with in real time? And are we going to see some changes to try to head off some of those concerns?
I think medical staffs share a lot of the experiences and the things they learn. Everybody's looking for some technology to solve this. And this is really about understanding the game and the people and how to relate the data and the technology back to the player. because it all starts with the game is still the same in that you got to put the ball in the hoop, and we're finding more efficient and different ways to do that. You know, when we look at football and we look at basketball, they're both evolving. Football, we're throwing the ball more. We're playing, you know, we have 40-yard pass plays. We don't have 4-yard run plays nearly as often anymore. We're moving the ball down the field, so guys are running more. In the same way, basketball, over time, we're seeing more stopping and starting. We're seeing more of these drives where there's contact, but we're not seeing the same types of scenarios where a guy's cutting and pivoting and trying to take something to the hole. Because of that, we've got to evolve in our training. But I also think that the bodies that survive in the NBA then will be the bodies that are trained for the modern game. So you're not going to see certain big players who are going to be able to play until they're 40. The LeBron James scenario of like that dynamic once in a generation, you know, maybe once in a lifetime athlete, like those guys don't come around very often. Like up until now, he really has been fairly healthy throughout his career up until the last couple of years, but Father Time's undefeated. And I think we've got to take stock in the fact that like the Tom Brady's who have the one ACL and then play the rest of their career, those are pretty rare.
I want to jump ahead real quick, Robbie, to something that was further down my list, but this is a good setup for it. The game has changed, and you described that in a couple of different ways there. And this is important because we have this ongoing discussion, debate, rock fight on Twitter about load management and the second you start talking about this guy needs a rest day or this guy, they're ramping up and they're taking it slowly and this and that. And people start talking about, well, Kevin Durant's played all these minutes and invariably somebody goes and grabs a screenshot of Michael Jordan playing all 82 every year, every minute of every game, never was injured, never missed anything. He's Michael Jordan. He's a god. Or Wilt Chamberlain or whatever. And I get it. Like, it's tempting. It's fun to just say, well, you know, Michael Jordan wouldn't have missed that shot. Michael Jordan would have taken a day off. Michael Jordan would have, but the game has changed. Can you just give people the Reader's Digest version? There's a reference that I'm dating myself with. The 280 character Twitter version of why, or maybe it's not, if load management is justifiable and effective, and if managing guys' minutes is actually having a payoff, because we have the impossible standard of these legends of the past, my gut is that this is not a valid comparison because the way the game has changed. And of course, immediately people are going to say, well, yeah, it was more physical back then. There was hand checking, and they beat the shit out of each other on the way to the hoop. Why is it different now? Why are these practices, these training practices justified?
Well, again, it goes back to the modern athlete, right? Like the modern athlete as a person is also different in how they take load and everything. So let's start with a couple things in terms of when I ran the sports science program with the Wolves and ran player health. The first part is I have a philosophy where I don't believe that people should take game days off. I don't think that that's needed. And I don't think that that's the purpose of an NBA team is to have guys rest on game day. The goal is to have guys.
So load, just to be clear, you are anti-load management in that regard, but at least on game days.
But
for games.
But load management has a connotation. So if it means that I'm anti-load management for games, then yes, I'm anti-load management for games. That's not the time to give a guy off. Okay. That's the time for a player to play. If you want to adjust practice, then that's a different scenario. My philosophy is this. I believe in consistency, and I believe that you bring the overall volume of work down as the season goes on while bringing the intensity up. And your goal, if you do the same thing every day, just like if you're, you know, writing and doing your podcast, like if you do the same thing every day, it doesn't really feel like work. It doesn't really feel like load until you get hurt or you have something happen. So consistency is really, really key. And we need to individualize care. We did this with Washington. We did this with Minnesota, with the organizations that I work with. We're doing it in football as well now. But really the goal is to have each day kind of be in some ways the same. It's hard to do with travel. It's hard to do with back-to-backs, 3 and 4s, 4 and 5s. That's the scheduling challenge. But the playoffs do have a lot of time off. So how do you practice during the playoffs? How do you build that consistency? Players have new obligations more than ever before. And there's a lot of other things that go into building a load management program. But those were the principles that I believe in. And so do I think that there's good science to suggest there are high risk times for players? We know that the beginning of the season, whether it's football, baseball, basketball, the first month of the year, training camp, the first 2 weeks are the highest risk periods. That is that load management. We know that that's a high risk period. And there is a goal there of avoiding spikes, of not just saying, hey, go out and play 2 hours of 5-on-5. That's not a good idea. That's load management. And there's good data to suggest that that is something that we can use to mitigate injuries. As it relates to the regular season, as it relates to the postseason, this is on teams to monitor, not just practice, because I would challenge that most teams talk about load management as practice or games. But what happens when a guy comes in and just wants to put up shots at night? That's volume two. When a guy comes in and goes and lifts, that could be volume two. When a guy is, you know, biking, that could be volume two. So we've got to think about all of that volume and build consistency and educate people. One of the key things, and this is where I take the stuff that I do in healthcare and in tech and apply it back. We have the most educated population that we will ever have as of today in healthcare. Everybody knows about their own personal data and their own personal healthcare, and it's only going to become more so as we go forward. So for an athlete, I want to understand what causes strain on them, what the manifestations of that strain are. If you don't get a lot of sleep, does your knee hurt the next day? Like, how do you feel? Where does that go when you don't get sleep, when you play a double overtime game? And then how can I individualize that care? And Howard, the reason load management is really hard is because it takes a person to have that relationship with the player, to have those conversations and ask those questions and understand how do you manage that individual. That's hard to do. That's hard to scale. And that's why you see some teams that are able to execute it and some teams that aren't.
So the underpinning of it, or the premise, I think broadly, I know there's probably much more to this. I'm going to be as obnoxiously reductive as possible here. But in theory, the idea is we are going to try to prevent injury, prevent serious injury, extend players' careers, perhaps. That's kind of what the Spurs were doing with Tim Duncan when they started ratcheting down his minutes, you know, 10 years into his career, whenever he played another 10 years. How much research or how much science and actual data is there behind it? Like, do we know that this works? Do we know that keeping, you know, managing a guy's minutes, all the monitoring that teams now do with the devices on them and being able to see their, you know, all their levels and fatigue level and all this, are we still guessing, or is there good science and good data behind these decisions when it comes to whether it's load management? That's, you know, you may not agree with it, but some teams giving a guy a day off or playing only one night of the back-to-back, or whether it's simply monitoring minutes and having all these minutes restrictions, because these are things that frustrate fans and frustrate a lot of coaches, of course, too. There's still those battles going on. And I feel like as a reporter covering this league, I don't have clarity as to how much of this is soundly based and how much is still just kind of like, well, we think this is the right direction, and we're going to see how it plays out over time.
Yeah. And those are great questions. The reality is, look, minutes restrictions probably do help. Like what we saw with Steph Curry does help reduce the risk of injury. But your goal is to get that off so that the guy can play unrestricted.
Of course.
It's not easy for a coach to manage and say, hey, like the guy can only play 30 minutes. How do you handle that when you get to overtime? So some of these are more logistical challenges, and some of these are, you know, difficult to execute in real time. Because how do you communicate that? Like, hey, can he go? Can he not go? What if he plays 10 straight minutes? Is that too much? These are the minutiae and kind of the personal level details that I think are important. But there is very good data to suggest that some of the things that we measure, whether it's distance, high-speed distance, jumps, what we call physiologic load or mechanical load and accelerations, that they do actually result in risk of certain types of injuries, tendinosis, hamstring injuries, soft tissue, calf strains, all of those fall into, I look at high speed distance, I look at distance, I look at jumps, I look at all of those different metrics, but I individualize them back to what those people have, like what their own normative data is, and then what their anatomic risk factors are. It does take people who have some sort of medical and biomechanical background, and it also takes someone who understands data. Those people aren't necessarily easy to find, because working in the NBA is not something that everybody wants to do either. And then executing on it, and then, hey, the device didn't work today. It's really hard. And I think we've made a lot of progress. I do think that the data definitely can be used to guide return to play and predict injury. It's just not the easiest thing for every person within the organization to understand how to execute on it.
Okay, but the rationale is sound in your mind. The basis for this, this is the right strategy. It may not be perfect, and we may not know exactly. You know, obviously, there's no 100% on anything, especially something as unpredictable as trying to prevent injuries. But the rationale behind it and the data that at least we have to date justifies this approach in your mind.
Absolutely. And we have very good data from abroad. We have very good data from even the NBA and from the NFL over the last few seasons that it does make a difference. But again, you see different levels of execution.
Yeah. All right. So I'm curious. I want to throw a few individual players at you, certain cases, just because I think they're fascinating from just a health standpoint and an injury standpoint. Kevin Durant suffered what we usually consider to be the most devastating injury in basketball, tearing that Achilles back in 2019. And at the time, I think there was reasonable concern that maybe Kevin Durant is never Kevin Durant again. And what we've seen of him the last couple of years, when he plays, and I have to qualify it, when he plays, he's playing as great as he's ever been. He looks like an MVP candidate each of the last two seasons. Just this season, I'll flag real quick. Third highest scoring average of his career this year at 29.9 points a game was challenging for the scoring title. His effective field goal percentage was 570, which is about middle of the pack for Kevin Durant, but outstanding by anybody else's standards. His PER was over 25, and he was fifth in the NBA in PER for what that's worth, just as kind of a snapshot. And so he's been outstanding. And on some level, you would look at it and say, well, Kevin Durant is an Achilles success story. Maybe it's okay. Let me throw the butt in and then let you educate me on this. He's played 90 out of 154 possible games over the last 2 years. That's 58% of the games. So is he a success story because he's still playing at an outstanding Kevin Durant otherworldly level? Or is there also still showing how tough it is to come back from the Achilles because he's had these other injuries that may or may not be related that have caused him to miss 64 out of 154 games over that time?
So what if I told you that this was exactly what was expected? So the reality is 71% of players with an Achilles tendon injury have a soft tissue injury the next year. So that was really expected that he'd have something when he came back. I would say anything above 66% of games played was going to be an unmitigated, unbridled success in that scenario. That was going to be a great success. He was going to have injuries. He had the complicated fifth metatarsal before. I would argue in some ways, like you could say that he was kind of injury prone beforehand. And so with all of this, now he's had a hamstring, an ankle, an MCL, calf strains, the fifth metatarsal. Like he's had a lot of things and he's a unicorn. He's a complete unique body with a unique skill set. The question here was not whether or not he could come back and play at a high level. Dominique Wilkins came back and was an all-star after his Achilles tendon tear. We've seen players come back and be very, very good. But the question is he a max player? If he's an MVP player for 60% of games, is he a max player? Well, he's a max player because of the way we do contracts. But as far as how you build your salaries within your organization, you think about, well, that means I've got to find somebody to play 40% of the games at 80% of that level. That's the challenge that I think a team faces, because he's somebody that we knew when we built models and we looked at what his likely performance was. We said 60%. We said he's going to miss 40% of games. He should be able to play at about 90 to 95% of his prior level. because of his skill set and his game type and because of when he was hurt relative to his career, but he's going to miss time. And are you comfortable with that?
Yeah. No, well, and you obviously, you nailed the projection there almost on the nose in terms of games missed and games played. But to be clear, because you started to say it, but I was interrupting you at the time. He is a success story to the extent that he has come back from his Achilles and still been one of the top, however, top two, three, wherever you want to put him, players on earth when he plays. But that is a tough, you know, that's difficult for the Nets. And it kind of, when you think about what they've done, obviously they brought him and Kyrie in together. Kyrie gets hurt all the time too. And then they make the trade for James Harden and you can, like, that did not work out, right? And then they had to flip Harden for Ben Simmons. Ben Simmons hasn't played. We can talk about Simmons in a minute. But I almost, you could understand where you want the third star, even if it feels like excess. Then they gave up a lot of depth to get Harden. And right now we're all talking about, oh, they'd be better off with Jared Allen, Caris LeVert. I myself have, I think, said that. But you kind of get it. Like, if you don't think you're going to, if you know for a fact, because of the stats you just gave me, Robbie, about Achilles' return, if you know you're not getting him for 40% of games, and you could be pretty sure of that, you kind of need a James Harden and a Kyrie Irving to take up the slack.
Yep. And look, is there a scenario for you to string out so he misses fewer games and plays fewer minutes? You kind of have to look at, like, how you want to approach his game, his personality, how he fits your team. Yeah, the Kyrie Irving COVID issue over the course of the season. You had Harden being out with his plethora of soft tissue issues. Then you have Simmons. It's just been a tough deal for the Nets. I mean, yeah. It's hard to evaluate whether they would consider it a success. I'm sure they would, because they got MVP Kevin Durant. They would do that deal. But what do you do with the lessons of how to manage players, how to manage health? That's where ultimately I think there are some lessons for them to learn too.
Well, I don't want to go too far into this, but I want to hit it because you used a phrase that always fascinates me, which is Kevin Durant is kind of injury prone, you said. And I think of Anthony Davis as like the poster child for being injury prone in the NBA. Like his whole career has been just stops and starts, and it's frustrating as hell if you're an Anthony Davis fan or if you're any of the teams that had him. Is injury prone scientifically, not from a sports fan perspective, is injury prone a real thing? Are some guys just going to get hurt more than others? Is just because the way they're built?
Yeah, there's definitely anatomic risk factors. It's how you take care of your body, how you recover. All those things are real. And, you know, to look at Anthony Davis, just some of the injuries that he's gone through over the last couple seasons, plantar fasciitis, the Liz Frank sprain, the calf strain, the knee injury, thumb injury, groin strain, another calf strain. Like, that's a lot over a 2-year span. Once you
that's get just that, the last 2 years.
Yeah. Once you have that, it's hard to overcome. And so you got to have rest. And you hope that, like, that off season, when you have a little bit of a longer off season, that you use it to recalibrate, adjust, anti-inflammatory, you know, diets, a little bit of weight loss, a little bit of, you know, conditioning, getting back slowly into the consistency. Because remember, the first month should be your highest volume, but your lowest intensity, and you bring up your intensity as the season goes on. That's my philosophy and how I train athletes. And so for Anthony Davis, he's got to have a complete reset. He's got to start from ground zero. He's got to approach like, hey, how do I play injury free for a period of time and avoid some of these risk factors? I would say it's, you know, with that number of soft tissue injuries, he's going to be high risk for the foreseeable future for his career. And he's got to really, you know, build a recovery program so that he's not putting on excess load, so that he's not putting on inconsistent loads day to day, and that he has the same routine every single day. But that's a lot for any player to go through. And especially someone as talented as him, you know, everybody wants to see him and LeBron have a good run. We've seen it when they were healthy, the result of it, but it's really, really hard to do. And, you know, for LeBron, it's the same thing. Like, one injury begets another, and core strength, all the things that they're trying to emphasize with the modern training, you know, when you're in your 30s, it's not easy. Like, I turned 40 this year and everything hurts.
It doesn't get any better after. I'm not going to date myself too badly, but I'm a bit ahead of you age wise. It's not going to get any better, Robbie. I'm sorry to say. You know that better than I do because you have the data. So this brings up the Laker thing is interesting because and I'm not an asterisk guy. There's no asterisk on the bubble season. There's no asterisk on lockout seasons. There are no asterisks. However, the Lakers had that three-month break in the middle of the 2020 season before the bubble. And I would assume from a medical standpoint, you would say that was a huge benefit to them with an older LeBron and an injury-prone Anthony Davis.
Probably helped them. And I'm sure that, you know, those guys weren't sitting around. They were shooting hoops at home, and they had their slow buildup to get back. Yeah, absolutely. Like those kinds of scenarios benefit older athletes. They benefit players like that. And so that's where, you know, whether it's, you know, a guy like Steph Curry having a little bit of rest going into the playoffs, because they slowly built him back up. I think they did a really nice job of building him back in this series. That's probably going to pay dividends for them.
Yeah. Real quick, I want to just last thing on kind of minutes load management stuff. Brian Levinson, friend of mine, sports psychologist, tweeted this, I think it was a week ago, and I flagged it immediately knowing that you and I were going to talk about some of these things. And I wanted to just run this by you. So he tweeted, fascinating to see NBA stars have minutes limited throughout the year, and then all of a sudden they ramp up to 40 plus minutes in the playoffs. Any sports science people have thoughts on how that can impact potential injuries during playoffs and performance? So this ties into what we were talking about. I figured it was worth touching on. So is Brian Levinson onto something there?
I think he is. And remember, my goal was to train a player to play 40 minutes. I wanted a guy to be able to play 40, because if he plays 40, then I don't have to worry about it. Most guys train to whatever the threshold is that they play, because how do you train a guy to play more if he only played 32? You've got to have higher intensity practices. You've got to do other things to get the volume up. Look, there's definitely something to it. I think the playoffs, the intensity does go up. We all know that the game slows down. It's a little more physical. I mean, the number of fouls that have been called in some of these games, like these teams are physical. So are the injuries a result of some of that too? I think that that's probably another thing that we've got to think about.
Sure. What do you think? I mean, obviously this is where I put you in the tough spot of diagnosing from, you know, 2000 miles away, but what do you make of the reports on Ben Simmons as you saw them unfold regarding his back? There was all this, you know, he's going to come back. He's almost ready. There's a setback. He had an epidural, all these things. Do you have any sense from the 30,000 foot view of where the Nets and Ben Simmons stand? This seems like a very concerning thing. He's now missed an entire season. Not all of that was due to the back, presumably, but there's also now this, there was a report the other day in The Athletic about the back is being triggered by his stress issues, the mental health part of that. So now it's all tying together. Any impressions that you got in that from a distance?
You know, I think just let's take the global perspective on back pain. Back pain is one of the most debilitating causes of, you know, people not being able to go to work in the country. So basketball's work. And when you have a back issue and you have an inability to, you know, go out there and perform, and all of a sudden you're, you know, ramping up to, again, high intensity playoff basketball, a must-win elimination game, I'm sure that there's a stress component. I'm sure that there is a back pain component that, hey, if you haven't played in a competitive NBA game in a year, and now you're being asked to come back and play in an elimination game, and your back has been tight for months because of this disc herniation, you've gotten an epidural, there's no question, like, an exacerbation is certainly not an unexpected outcome. Unfortunately, it's not like you have, hey, I'll just try again in a week. Your team got eliminated. So that's life. I think that's where, you know, when is someone ready? How do you keep someone ready? Back injuries are really, really tough. They're very, very complicated. And I sympathize with the Nets and how they had to handle that situation, because it's not easy. But those are things that you hope don't cause long-term issues. And that's the hope, I think, for the Nets, is that they should have a healthy Ben Simmons for next season. They should be able to pair him with whoever comes back, you know, particularly obviously Kevin. You should be able to have a full Ben Simmons season next year, where hopefully the mental health stuff, obviously, you hope that that gets better as well. But I'd be optimistic if I'm a Nets fan.
One more specific player I want to throw at you, and then we'll talk a little COVID before we close. Chris Middleton. I think it's the MCL that he's dealing with. And the latest report, I think as of this morning, is that maybe he's going to miss this entire series against the Celtics. I mean, this is the season now for the Bucks Celtics might be, you know, to decide who's going to win the East. No disrespect to any of the others in the East still hanging out, Heat and Sixers, if the Sixers survive. But I think Celtics Bucks is for who wins the East. And trying to play against the Celtics without Chris Middleton, that seems like a difficult task. Any sense of what they're facing with Middleton's injury?
Yeah, the MCL is a hard one to push on healing. And so, you know, grade twos are a couple weeks and grade threes are 4 to 6. And so if this is a, you know, in that kind of grade two garden variety MCL, it's a 2 to 3 week injury. And so there's really not a ton that you can do short of a little PRP injection to accelerate that healing. And what you don't want to do is put someone out there who has an unstable knee. And Milwaukee's got a great medical staff. They've done a great job of handling some of Chris's injuries over the years. Including the hamstring avulsion. So I'm sure that they're going to be very careful. I also think that they're a team that, you know, they've had a lot of other guys step up over the, you know, this past series and over the last two seasons. So I'm sure they're going to be very conservative, but that's going to be a very physical series. So they're going to be very, very careful.
Yeah. It's interesting. We'll see, you know, that's a team that, as great as Giannis is, I've always looked at the Bucks as kind of this ensemble cast, and Middleton is a key part of that. So that's going to be an interesting series without him. All right, let's talk COVID. You have spent a lot of time the last couple of years on these issues at the league level and team level, and across sports in your one of your roles. So far in this postseason, if we want to count the play-in round as the postseason, which it's kind of that weird middle ground. So we lose. Paul George misses the play-in game, and it's goodbye Clippers. Zach LaVine just missed an elimination game, goodbye Bulls. Those have been the only two, but there really are no NBA protocols anymore unless a guy is positive. No one's getting tested on a regular basis. Nobody's having to mask. No, like, all the rules are gone. The NBA is basically operating as if COVID is over, just like the rest of society is. But they still have NBA protocols if you test positive, and now you have to be quarantined, and now you have to be away from the team, and you have to miss games. So far, not a major impact, right? Nobody expected the Bulls to go far. No one expected the Clippers to go far. But Robbie, it's late April. We haven't even gotten to the second round yet. There are surging numbers across the country, certainly here in New York, where I am. And while we're all treating this as being over, I have to wonder, are we headed for trouble here? Are these NBA playoffs destined to be warped on some level by COVID quarantines, maybe even in the finals?
I think we would be remiss if we didn't think that COVID was going to have more cases in the NBA, whether it's players, coaches, medical staff, different folks within the organizations over the next 2 months. Before we get to the end of the season, we're going to have COVID cases pop up. And let's just take the general society view. We have four or five things now that we didn't have when we started that are meaningfully helpful in managing these cases. And we have one, I think, game changer that also helps in these situations. And the first is, you know, we understand how masks work and that masks reduce spread at a population level, at an individual level. We have vaccines, we have boosters, and I encourage everybody to get a COVID vaccination. And I encourage everybody who's eligible to get a booster because it reduces significantly your risk of getting COVID. We also know that ventilation and doing stuff outdoors and, you know, avoiding big gatherings helps. We also have an antiviral and tests now that really make a difference. And we are going to see players come back within a series much faster because we have antivirals available now. We are going to see the management and treatment of COVID evolve now as well. And one of the key things here is that people who get COVID continue to be infectious and spread this virus for an extended period of time. That's why we're protecting people. The reality is you're still contagious for probably a period of 4 to 5 days, unless you're on Paxlovid. Maybe that really does minimize your level of contagiousness beyond 5 days. That's the game changer that teams, organizations, populations across the world will be able to use. That Paxlovid and similar antivirals will be able to make a difference if you can take it. There are obviously some contraindications, but we're going to see COVID. We're going to see COVID this season. We're going to see COVID next season. And I think we need to start to think about what happens next year. What happens during summer league, when somebody gets COVID, are they still out 5 days? They probably are. And that's not the life that we're used to, Howard, where these people get better after 2 days and they're like, I still have to be out 3, 4, 5 days. What does that mean? And that's not the, hey, you're sick with the flu and you come back and you play in an NBA finals game. That's not the Jordan flu game life that we are used to. The world is different and how we manage illness is going to be different. And so for people, I think the message here for the listeners is this is a time to advocate for your individual health, for the public health wellness of everybody out there. Get your vaccine, get your booster. I will tell you, I personally still choose to wear a mask. And that's because I have 2 unvaccinated little kids at home. And for me, until they're able to get vaccinated, I have to protect them on their margins. I have family members who have chronic illness. I have to protect them. That's important to me. And so I value it. And I wear an N95 or a KN95 virtually everywhere I go. And I think we should embrace the fact that people are educated. And I want people to get the right information about where they can go get a COVID vaccine, why they should get it, where they can go get a good test, where they can get treatment. COVID.gov is a phenomenal resource. It's the best probably resource that the government has created over the last 2 years. If you have questions, if you need to find out where you can get Paxlovid, go to the website. It's there. And that can be a huge, huge benefit to you and your family.
All great advice. Are you still, for the general person, should we all still be wearing masks on planes and subways and all the places that just got suspended? Those rules got suspended. But for me, like personally, like I don't worry about it most of the time, but I feel like close quarters with a lot of people packed in, I'm still kind of hyper conscious of it myself. That's kind of my brain's been conditioned that way. You recommend still masks on planes, trains, other tight spaces?
I do right now, Howard. There's a lot of COVID in the community right now. Cases are going up. We're missing a lot of cases, obviously, because of at-home testing. I do recommend masking in those scenarios. And again, once we get to a place where there's less COVID this summer, you will be able to unmask and feel good and probably ride the subway and go to restaurants and not worry about that stuff. We're not there yet. I'm a little bit worried about some of the stuff internationally, but just focusing on what we're seeing here, there is a pathway for us to, again, I've said for months, we're going to have a good summer. It's going to be a good summer. We're going to have an awesome NBA finals. People can probably be unmasked in some of those scenarios, but we've got to get there. And that means dropping the number of cases from where we are today to a lower level so that we can go forward. We can vaccinate all our kids. We can give boosters to people who want them going into the fall. And we'll be able to have a pretty normal NBA season next year, barring the emergence of some new variant that we're going to be able to have still tools. Every one of the things I described still works. So we're much, much better off than we were 2 years ago, but we still have to manage this and we've got to be able to protect the lowest common denominator.
Good summer, normal NBA season. This is all music to my ears. These are all things I'm very much looking forward to. Of course, it would be nice if New York would actually do spring before we get to summer. It's still winter here today.
Yeah, I said summer. I'm not making any promises on spring. I have no affiliation with the National Weather Service. they've really disappointed me this year. It was 19 degrees in Minnesota the other day. And I'm still waiting for my spring in Minnesota too.
All right. Well, let's hope that both on the COVID front and the weather front, we have a wonderful summer eventually when we get there, if we ever get through whatever this spring is. Robbie Sicca, thank you for spending the time as always. The information is fantastic. And folks, as he said, it's COVID.gov, correct?
Correct.
Go to COVID.gov, get all the information there. If people want to follow you on Twitter, you don't tweet very often, but you often have some great links and information there. Where do they find you? Where do they find you on Twitter?
Robbie Sicca on Twitter.
Just at Robbie Sicca. That's as easy as it gets. Thank you, my friend. Been great.
Thanks, Howard. Appreciate it.
Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Dr. Robbie Sicca. Thanks to our producer, Shelby Royston. And thank you all for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And then on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. And hit me with all your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.